Hello again from the Baltimore Sun. I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Roughly Speaking, episode 286 for Thursday, the 10th of August, 2017. Actually, I'm renaming the show just for this episode. This Old Valve House, we're going to call it. This Old Valve House, and that's because we're going to be hearing about a historic landmark in Baltimore that, with a little love and a few million bucks, could probably become a coffee house or farmer's market or cool concert venue. It's the Old Valve House in Clifton Park on the northeast side of the city. My colleague Jacques Kelly calls it the Little Castle on Sanlo Drive. And if you've never seen it, you should check it out next time you're in that part of the town. It's a stunning architectural tribute to public works. It was the Valve House for a reservoir that used to be in Clifton Park, and Clifton Park was once the estate of Johns Hopkins. Anyway, the Valve House is a cool old building. I called it cool once already, but it is. It's a cool old building in need of attention, and it's one of the things we'll be discussing today with Nick Redding. He's Executive Director of Preservation Maryland. We'll also hear about a battle, and it looks like a losing battle, in the city of Cumberland in western Maryland to save an old mill worker neighborhood from the wrecking ball. Also today, Preservation Maryland's efforts to help repair historic buildings in Ellicott City after last summer's flood. And if you're looking for a contractor to help you renovate an old house or building, there's a sort of an Angie's List for that now, and Nick Redding will tell us about that. First, we got a book recommendation from Paula Gallagher. This one is a futuristic sci-fi with a love story at its center and a novel that was crowdfunded through the publisher Inkshares.
Dan, this week I have a fun book called The Punch Escrow by Tal M. Klein. And this is one of those great books for August. It's a page-turning thriller in a sci-fi package. This is hard sci-fi with a lot of science backing it, but it's still an accessible, fun read. It's set in the year 2147, and we are no longer ruled by our government. We're ruled by corporations. So there's some interesting conceits in this book, but our main character is Joel Byram. He works with artificial intelligence, trying to get them to be better at more nuanced interactions with humans. And in order to do this, he works with language, brain teasers, and puns, and trying to get this artificial intelligence to think a little bit more like humans. It's a job that really suits him well. He's kind of a slacker. He's kind of a smartass. He's not the real breadwinner in the family. That would be his wife. She is a senior research scientist for a company called International Transport, and she works in world teleportation. So that's the real interesting spin that this book works with. In this future, we can now teleport people from one place to another in a matter of seconds. But things go horribly wrong. Strong on plot. Not so much so on characterization or description. He uses a lot of color words, blue shirt, black pants. So you're not going to read it for turn of phrase, but you're reading it for plot and excitement, and it has that in spades. This book, just before it was published, was optioned by Lionsgate for film. And any fan of that harder sci-fi, anybody who's a Trekkie, would really enjoy this book. It's also got a love story at its core. Again, you're not going to marvel at the language. There's a lack of nuance, but the high concept ideas and the plot will easily translate to the screen and, if you will, the screen of your imagination. The science is plausible, and this book is interesting because it won a contest. There's a publishing company called Inkshares. And in order to get your book published, you submit some chapters to Inkshares, and they put them online. And if people like what they read, they get to read a few free chapters, then they'll go ahead and publish your book, and they'll help you edit it, design it, and manufacture and distribute the book. And so this is coming out from Inkshares in conjunction with a site called Geek and Sundry, who won a contest. And the idea of the contest is whoever was writing this piece of fiction needed to write a hard science fiction. So again, this is The Punch Escrow by Tal Klein.
Paula Gallagher is a librarian in the Baltimore County Public Library System. She notes that her husband, Sean Gallagher, recommended that she review The Punch Escrow. And speaking of Sean, he'll be on the show next week. IT and National Security Editor for Ars Technica, Sean Gallagher will be talking about hacking elections, tracking Russians, and how GPS needs a backup navigational system.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent, locally owned bookseller. The shop offers the best in literature, current affairs, history, poetry, and, of course, books about Baltimore. The Ivy is located at Falls Road at Lake Avenue in Mount Washington. Check us out at theivybookshop.com. The right book is waiting.
Okay, moving right along, it's time for This Old Valve House. Nick Redding of Preservation Maryland shares some information about a great old building in Baltimore's Clifton Park, built in 1887 to house waterworks. The Valve House has been abandoned and in disrepair for 50 years. Civic Works, the community service nonprofit that trains young people in building skills, has an eye on that place. There's talk about turning it into a coffee house, perhaps a farmer's market. Of course, money is needed to restore it. So Nick Redding will be talking about that, the Valve House, as well as Preservation Maryland's role in helping to repair historic buildings damaged in the Ellicott City flood last summer. Also, we're going to hear about a battle over a section of Cumberland in Allegheny County in western Maryland. The Cumberland Economic Development Corporation plans to buy and demolish some 60 homes near Interstate 68 in what's called the Rolling Mill neighborhood on the east side of the city, which has been through some rough times. The plan is to knock down the houses to make room for a commercial development. The city says the area has been an eyesore for years and a source of criminal activity. Cumberland's economic development director told Washington TV station WJLA that some homeowners were happy to be bought out. The Cumberland Times News reports that more than half of the targeted homes have already been demolished. But other longtime homeowners are determined to stay in Rolling Mill, and they've put up a resistance. So there's some background for our chat with Nick Redding, executive director of Preservation Maryland. Nick, what was the scope of Preservation Maryland's work with regard to Ellicott City after the flood last summer?
Our work in Ellicott City started just a few hours after the floodwaters receded. We got some calls in from friends in the local area who said something really bad has happened here. You guys need to take a look at this. And so we got information, started fundraising really as well the day after, because we knew it was going to be a big job. And initially what we did when we were first called in was sort of building triage. So there were buildings that had initially been hit so hard, and really I can't emphasize how powerful these floodwaters were. I mean, an example of that is the force of the water itself and then the debris that it kicked up pulled the granite steps off of buildings. You know, that kind of gives you a sense for how powerful this was. But there were buildings that were damaged so badly that there was some concern about whether or not they would continue to stand and that they may have to be the subject of an emergency demolition. And so Howard County went in with their engineers. They started looking at them and they said, these got to come down. And we were able to use our influence to get sort of a second engineering opinion. We brought in preservation engineers that we were familiar with who really knew buildings inside and out. We work with a firm called Keystone Hood that has done massive preservation projects from, the Statue of Liberty, things like that. And they were able to come up with preservation engineering schemes, basically, to save all the buildings. So our first big victory there was we didn't lose a single building to demo in the days that followed. And that was a lot of work initially because it gets very confusing. There's layers of government. You don't know really who's in charge, who's going to make that decision, who's going to say, yes, that building can stand. It was really a lot of work, in the cell phone in those first few days.
Did the county work with you on that?
Yeah, and I have to say that, after a lot of disasters, maybe not so much here in Maryland, but if you look around the country, New Orleans is an example after Hurricane Katrina, the government wasn't always the biggest issue for them, wasn't always preservation. And, that's the reason that the Lower Ninth Ward is sitting at the bottom of Lake Pontchartrain. But I have to say that the experience of working with Howard County government, in particular Alan Kittleman, he really emphasized how valuable the heritage of that community was, knew it from day one, and was really willing to work with us. I mean, he put demands on there. He had to make sure that it was safe, because first and foremost, you got to worry about public safety. It was his ability to work with us that really saved all those buildings.
So they were patient.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because you needed to bring in your engineering expert.
Yeah, we had to bring in engineers, and it took a little while, but they were definitely very patient and very concerned. I mean, they made preservation one of the, history heritage preservation, one of the major tenets upon which they would rebuild Ellicott City, which I think says a lot
Well, it is historic Ellicott City. You hardly say the words Ellicott City without the word historic in front of it.
Right. You can't really separate the two. And so then our work shifted from sort of this initial building triage and engineering strategies to survey documentation. How badly did this impact everything? What is the extent of this? And so we worked with a couple firms that we're familiar with who were able to donate some of their services. We worked with a firm called Direct Dimensions, which is based in Baltimore County, but they're a national firm, and they do laser scanning. And they scanned the district down to the 2-millimeter level of accuracy. So we have a snapshot of Ellicott City after that flood that's probably the most accurate data snapshot of Ellicott City ever. And it'll help in terms of not only we understand about the history of this flood, but it'll also help in terms of how we plan to make Ellicott City more resilient. So we've handed that data over. We also worked with a firm called Elevated Element, and they did drone scanning of the entire district as well. And they did something called photogrammetry, where they take hundreds of images a second, and then they stitch them all together in a computer program to create a 3D model of what it is that they've done. So we have a really good snapshot of what happened. And that may sound insignificant, but after the 72 Agnes, a lot of changes happened to the district, and we don't really know because we don't know the extent of what the damage was. And so actually after the 2016 flood, we were finding, oh, that was a change that was made in 72, which has now just fallen off, and we're seeing the original fabric, the original material. So it really is important in a historic district to kind of have
to record what things look like at the time.
Yeah. Right? And what happened, it is a historic moment in and of itself. And then we switched. Then a month later, so August 30th, the flood hit, July 30. August 30, we announced and worked with county government and county executive Kittleman to open up a field office of the organization. And we staffed that with two folks that we hired specifically for the job. And they were there for a year. And they were providing technical assistance. They were doing everything from helping people to find contractors to helping people kind of navigate the crazy and very difficult financial background of rehab. So there's tax credits, there's loans, there's grants, there's a lot of things that are out there, particularly after a disaster. And what we found was there were all these open houses and workshops and things like that, and people kind of get workshopped to death after a disaster. And so that one-on-one, hands-on approach we found was the most useful, and particularly with something as complex as rehab. Because, if you think about it, a lot of us, you're a homeowner, I'm a homeowner, tackling a rehab project under the best of circumstances is hard, right? There's things that pop up, it's difficult, it's expensive, it's confusing. Imagine doing that after having lost everything. And that gives you a sense for where these people were. Yeah, and your business.
Not just your home, but a business that was providing you a livelihood.
Right, and you're not generating income now, but you're expected to spend perhaps the most you've ever spent ever.
Well, how were the owners of those businesses in terms of cooperating with you and being patient with your interests?
I think they were patient with us. I think we did an after-action report that we just recently published where we kind of take note and take survey of what went right, what went wrong. And I think some of the things I suggested, just sort of talked about were some of the things that went right. Some of the things that went wrong perhaps weren't things that we did specifically, but were a component of that work, which was some of the tax credits that we attempted to provide to folks and help them use, they're just not well suited for Main Streets. And actually the National Main Street Center, the group that sort of oversees, when you say Main Street, Ellicott City or those sorts of things, that group actually used our work in Ellicott City to sort of provide and create a case study for how we need to improve some of these laws, because it was a really dynamic snapshot of how some of the infrastructure, some of the incentives that are available don't work as well for a small Main Street business as they may, a massive commercial building in downtown Baltimore. I think what we found is it's difficult for a Main Street business. And a lot of these businesses also didn't have flood insurance. And even if you do have flood insurance, it's almost impossible to insure your wares. So they lost all of their stock. So it was difficult. I think that what we did find is that they wanted the help. They needed the help. And we were one of the few organizations that you know, were there in the immediate aftermath and then stuck around for a considerable amount of time. And final stage is we're going to be working with another local group to give out about $50,000 in grants to nonprofits and components of Howard County government that are doing work in Ellicott City. We're calling our revitalization grant program to try and jumpstart and help revitalize aspects of the community, make it even better than it ever was.
Did people respond to your call for donations at this time?
Yeah, absolutely. I think Ellicott City taught us a couple different things. You know, we had previously been a funder of preservation. We'd been an organization that provided technical assistance. We've certainly been an advocate. But we had never responded in this way after a natural disaster. And I think it opened our eyes to the fact that when you do that, you're going to make a lot of friends. You're going to gain a lot of supporters. You expand your universe of partners. But it's also an opportunity for us to show how historic preservation, we're sort of painted into this corner where, you know, well, you're about old house museums and fancy old things. Whereas we see our work, yeah, that's a component of it, but we see our work just as much as about community vibrancy and preservation being a tool for that. And this was an opportunity to showcase not only that, but how preservation, our history, our heritage could be the bedrock upon which a community could be rebuilt.
Now to the Valve House in Clifton Park in Baltimore. I drive by this place, I don't know, 7-8 times a year, and I always look at it and say, when are we going to save this old building? So we have to describe what it is, what it was, and then we want to talk about the effort to preserve it.
And people have been looking at the Valve House for and talking about rehabbing it or restoring it or preserving it for 30, 40 years now. It is what it sounds like. It's a valve house. It was a place where all the pumping system was for a reservoir, and so they could actually pump water. And many years ago, when we built to last, you know, our civic infrastructure not only was made to work well, but it was also oftentimes very beautiful. And so this beautiful iron and stone and terracotta, all these different elements come together in this beautiful structure. I can't imagine building a pumping station like that nowadays.
Right.
It would be considered a gross misuse of government dollars, yeah, probably, to build something that beautiful. But, you know, I guess the fact that it's been vacant for so long and it's still standing is reason enough to save this place. Civic Works, which is located there in that same park, is the partner with us on this project. They have recently, you know, to great expense, rehabbed the Clifton House, which was Johns Hopkins, you know, summer home.
Mansion, yeah, mansion. Summer mansion.
Yeah, summer mansion. They would like to, if they can, tackle this project. There's a lot of barriers in place. The city owns it, and then there's neighborhood groups to contend with about what are you going to do with this.
Can I just say, it's a great landmark.
It is.
I don't care. It doesn't have a usefulness anymore, right?
There's
no utility to it,
well,
although you could have concerts inside if you wanted. But I'm just saying, approaching it, walking near it, seeing it from a distance, it is a stunning landmark.
It's a stunning landmark, but we think that that alone generally, or rarely, I guess I should say, ever saves a historic place. The fact that it's beautiful, it has to have some utility at the end of the day. And so in the case of the Valve House, we are working to try and identify different uses. So that was one of the tools that we've brought to the table as a component of the project. And we had a junior architectural designer on staff for a while with us. She's now moved on to go and get her graduate degree in architecture. But she put together a bunch of different scenarios in which this could be reused. And one of the uses of it that we're looking at, a couple different uses, and these are all sort of theoretical at this point, could it be a farmer's market? Because Civic Works does sort of a farming exchange there with kids and teaching them about gardening and things like that. Could they sell it in this place? Could we rehab it into that? Could it be a farmer's market and a little cafe? Because there's some second floor levels. There's a way to get people in and out. So we are looking at ways in which that could be done. So the barriers, the hurdles to that are, you know, it's city owned. So the city would have to transfer ownership or at least convey a lease. And Civic Works would have to raise a whole heck of a lot of money to do this. But I think first and foremost, you have to figure out, why does a building matter? Why is it still relevant to a community beyond the fact that it's beautiful? Is there some utility to it? And I think that, you know, what we've found is, yeah, there's different ways of reusing this.
Hmm. So I said concerts.
Concerts.
I mean,
could
I could see
way.
It as a concert hall now and then.
Yeah.
All right, Nick, I want to go to Western Maryland with you, Allegheny County to Cumberland, because Preservation Maryland draws attention to buildings, places that are threatened. Rolling Mill in Cumberland. People may be familiar with this if they're on Route 68 headed west or east going over Cumberland, where the highway goes over the city at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about Rolling Mill, historic value, what's there, and how is it threatened?
Rolling Mill, and really what we're talking about is the neighborhood, the Rolling Mills community. That neighborhood draws its name from rolling mills, steel rolling mills that used to stand there. They no longer stand. But the community sprang up around it, not surprisingly, to house the workers. And so these are very vernacular, sort of early 20th century, late 19th century workers' housing. But workers' housing that was, built by the owners in many cases, solid, beautiful brick homes. And it's a community that, as you mentioned, that sits very close to an interstate. And so it is eyed by developers as a potential place for some type of development right off the highway, because you know a lot of people like this idea of jumping off the highway, going, grabbing something, and getting right back on. And so the city of Cumberland, working with their economic development corporation, sort of similar to the Baltimore Development Corporation, Cumberland has the same thing, the Cumberland Economic Development Corporation, their CEDC. They identified that this would be a great place for redevelopment, that this would be a great opportunity. And so,
are the homes still occupied?
Well, at the beginning of this project, yeah, they were. And there were some vacants mixed in, like in many, Maryland cities, we have vacancies, but it was by no means a completely vacant neighborhood.
Excuse me, how many homes are we talking about?
Yeah, there's probably about 60 to 80 homes in the whole area, depending on how you define it. And the city and the Economic Development Corporation began to buy people out, acquire their homes, and assemble them. And then eventually it became public what they were attempting to do, which is to take all of these homes, as well as some businesses, a church that was built in the historic period, and demolish all of it, turn it over to a for-profit developer, and have them put in, and it still remains to be seen exactly what it is, but some of the plans that were released basically were a glorified strip mall. And this taking place within less than a mile, maybe a quarter of a mile or something like that, of huge vacant properties, just open land where the old rolling mills actually used to stand. Hmm. So it's not as if there isn't a place that couldn't already absorb commercial or economic growth.
This place is closer to the highway.
This place is closer to the highway. Hmm. Yeah. So we stepped in at the request of homeowners. We didn't get involved. We didn't try and stick our nose in someone else's business without an invite. But homeowners were really concerned and really scared about what was happening. There were people who didn't want to move. They had no interest in it, who had been there for multi-generations or had recently made a big investment in a historic property and didn't really want to leave. And so we came in and started meeting with them, offered to help them with planning. We came up with several different options that we thought would be a way of providing for both the economic vitality of the community as well as providing for the preservation of this community, or at least the people who wanted to stay. So we went everything from infill development, where you take out some things and then you put in mixed-use redevelopment within there, to community land trusts, to coming up with sort of a broader strategy for that area. And we offered to put money into that, and the city of Cumberland just was not interested. So they've continued to pursue this path. It has divided the community. It's ballooned in its cost over this period of time.
It cost to buy out the homeowners,
cost to buy out the homeowners, cost of demolition, everything that we said was going to happen pretty much at the beginning, that this was a boondoggle and that they could avoid all of this and come out of it looking really great. Unfortunately, those things happened. In the course of this, it also came clear that the city and the Economic Development Corporation were considering the use of eminent domain to move people out who were no longer or weren't willing to sell.
And what they consider economic development.
Right. Yeah,
which maybe you called it a glorified strip mall. I mean, it's supposed to be a retail mall, a brick and mortar
stores. Well, I wouldn't
stores.
Say mall, but yeah, stores. Stores, offices, things like that.
Isn't that interesting? When, the trend seems to be against brick and mortar retail.
Right.
Right? Which is another whole subject we should talk about someday.
Right.
This idea that all those old malls, they are old now.
Right.
Malls, strip malls, shopping centers. People are sitting at home ordering clothes and potholders online,
right,
instead of going to these stores.
It's also extremely auto-dependent.
It's auto-dependent, too.
And we made the case that they're transferring a walkable community for a car-dependent community, which is sort of the reverse trend of where we stand.
Well, excuse me. I just want to say, I mean, any time the instinct is to tear down houses where people are still living. In Baltimore City, I have less of a problem when you're talking about vacant homes and blocks that haven't been occupied for years. I got to stop there and say, why are you doing that? Why aren't you maybe improving this community? Why aren't you making it look better, provide more infrastructure that's more conducive to a nice city neighborhood?
Right.
And do they, was the view, well, it's near the highway, it's not that attractive, the housing stock is not that great. Is that the kind of thing you heard?
Or? Yeah, all of the above. And I wanted to make the point that on the eminent domain, they never really said whether or not they were going to use it. It became clear that it was perhaps on the table, and that drew the attention of a group called the Institute for Justice, which is a libertarian law firm. And they got involved and have actually filed suit. And so
against the city?
Yeah, against the city and the Economic Development Corporation.
It's an interesting ally to have.
It is. Preservation makes for strange bedfellows sometimes. But, you know, I think what it suggests is that across the board, across all political spectrums, and, you know, we're nonpartisan, but it just didn't add up and it's just not a great plan. And there could have been so much more. The reaction of the people there speaks to, you know, sort of the greater reaction people were having to this. And, you know, we didn't find a lot of people who thought this was a great idea other than those in city government.
So what's the status of it then? How many folks have moved out?
You
said there were 60 to 80 homes.
Yeah, there. Yeah. I don't know what the latest count is on the exact moment right now. There are probably a few dozen left. Dozens have moved or been bought out. Demolition's taking place all the time. So they've torn out as much as they possibly can. They've gotten some state funding now for the first time, which will trigger a historic preservation review, which we intend on being a part of. And it remains to be seen how that'll all play out. They have not yet demolished the church, which I think should make for some interesting pictures when city government moves in on a historic church.
Nick Redding, one last thing I want to ask you about during this visit to the podcast. Preserve list. This is for contractors who do work, home renovations, preserving older homes, buildings, office buildings, whatever it is. Tell us about this.
Yeah, so I'd wager that the number one call we get to our office is, I'm looking for someone to do fill in the blank to my historic home. Do you have any recommendations? It's hard to find good skilled labor for a lot of these historic projects. And, you know, it's one of the kind of the concerns for the preservation community looking forward is, do we have enough skilled labor to do all of these things? The good news, at least in our area, is we have a lot of really great preservation contracting firms out there and a lot of really skilled craftsmen.
In Maryland.
In Maryland and regionally, really. Mm-hmm. And so what we've put together is a way for people to find all of that, because to this point, it's been very difficult. So we put together a site called PreserveList, which we're calling a Project of Preservation Maryland. It's a mid-Atlantic resource, so we hope to grow it beyond our own state borders. But the idea is to find people and to connect them with homeowners and property owners who need qualified assistance. So think of it as sort of like the Angie's List of preservation, in a sense.
For those who would make your list or be on your list, mm-hmm. do you do some sort of vetting?
Because of liability, we're not in a position where we're able to recommend or say that they're perfect. It is sort of a self-nominated
list. So you're
not
Angie's List.
We're not Angie's List in that sense.
But if someone has been doing this work, has a track record of it, and they want to get their company listed in a place where it would be consolidated with others.
Right.
That this is what it's for.
They turn to us. Yeah. They can pay to get on there, and it's very clear what it is. And it's a
listing. There's a fee to be listed.
There's a fee to be listed.
It goes to your 501c3.
That's right. It helps us cover our bottom line. And the good thing about it is that, you know, what we recommend is, like anybody, you should, you know, get references on a contractor, and we give them an opportunity to provide references, provide pictures of previous projects. So, you know, we can't speak to the ability of these people to do it, but, you know, it is a good way for us to kind of connect people and resources.
That's the Preserve List, about which you can find information on the Preservation Maryland website. Nicholas Redding, thank you for being with us again. Good luck with these projects, and I feel like I need to champion the Valve House. I drive by it 6 or 7 times a year, and I think, what's going to happen there? So maybe I'll make that a pet cause of mine.
Sounds good. Appreciate it.
Nick Redding is Executive Director of Preservation Maryland. Further reading, a video and photographs about the Valve House, the Rolling Mill Battle in Cumberland, and Ellicott City after the flood can be found by following the links in the notes with this podcast. You can also find a link to the Preservation Maryland website. And that's our show for now. Join us Friday to hear Baltimore bartender Brendan Dorr talk about cocktails that sharpen your appetite. We'll taste and discuss some aperitifs ahead of the weekend. So please join us for that. We welcome comments about our show on Facebook or Twitter, or just write to me here at the Baltimore Sun, drodricks@baltsun.com. For producer Steve Early, Dan Rodericks here, thanking you for listening to Roughly Speaking, and we'll see you again soon.